How Did You Think of That? With Temple Grandin.
And I'm Sherry Quinn. Observation tools like the Hubble and James Webb telescopes have fueled deeper explorations of the universe. In this episode, NASA's James Webb Telescope discoveries and implications for STEM education and technology. And what comes next? The search for habitable planets? Joining us is Dr. Mark Clampin, Astrophysics Division Director at NASA's headquarters in Washington, D.C.
And what that means is that I manage all of the astrophysics programs that NASA is currently running and will run in the future. And of course, when you think about our archives, it's also run in the past. But my sort of previous experience, you know, I started with NASA in 2003, and I served for just over 12 years as the observatory project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope. So, and before that, I was at the Space Telescope Science Institute for 10 years, where I was involved in all of the Hubble service emissions and was actually involved in building one of the cameras for Hubble, the advanced camera for surveys. So I have a lot of hands-on experience building hardware and basically taking science requirements and turning them into hardware that will meet and exceed those requirements.
That sounds really great. It takes the whole team to get things there.
You know, one of the things that I'm involved with right now is thinking about what comes after the James Webb. And there's a mission that we're currently in the process of building. But then there's a lot of, forward thinking and visualization about the mission that comes after that. And the National Academies have given us a recommendation. But it's my job to sort of visualize how to do that.
Dr. Clampin next explains what first motivated him to become an astrophysicist. It's the kind of observation that inspired many kids to shoot for the moon and beyond.
One of the things I always tell people is, I'm afraid it always sounds a little cliche, but it's true. I mean, watching Neil Armstrong walk on the moon was, key moment. And, one of the other things that I always resonated with was not just seeing Neil Armstrong, but also Apollo 13, seeing how NASA worked and how people came together as a team to bring Apollo 13
right.
back.
Well, that's right.
And then I'll even just mention Star Trek. You know, I used to watch the Enterprise going around those planets. And I'd be sitting there thinking, is that really what planets would look like? So I really wanted to do science in that area and try and understand, were there planets out there around other stars? And if so, what kind of planets were they? What did they look like? Would there be life? So that's very much, one of the things that motivates me.
Looking at the beautiful pictures that are sent back from the James Webb. And this brings up another thing that I, in my field, which is much more down on earth, is some people think that to be science, you have to have a controlled experiment. And I used to fight with my thesis advisor back in the 80s when I was getting my PhD. And I said, observation is part of science. What about the Hubble Space Telescope? What's its control? Pointed at the ground? That doesn't make much sense. But there's some people, at least in my field, which is more earthbound, think that if you don't, that observation doesn't matter. And observation does matter because observation gives you ideas for hypotheses for controlled experiments.
Absolutely. And look, you can make observations in different ways that anchor you to a single result. So I'll give you an example. Before I became director of astrophysics, I managed the sciences and exploration directorate at the Goddard Space Flight Center, which is one of NASA's centers. And there I was managing scientists from four different areas. So the astrophysicist, but also heliophysicists who study the sun, the planetary scientists who really study the objects in our solar system, and earth science, which was actually the largest by far. And, we would get people ask us, for instance, we had a mission that measured the height of ice in the Antarctic and also in Greenland, called ICESat-2. And people would say, well, how do you know that, that the result it's given you is correct? And in this case, we had a different mission that actually measured how much mass had gone from those areas. You could take the change in level of the ice from one measurement that you did with one mission and correlate that with the mass loss that you measured from a completely different mission and show that you actually had a result that was anchored by two very different measurements, but giving you the same result.
Well, that totally makes a lot of sense. I've been reading about some of the fabulous things satellites can do.
In Zoom calls with Temple, prominently in view in the background is her vintage poster of the Hubble telescope. It's one of her biggest inspirations and interests, and what led us to this conversation.
And when I think about the picture I love the most is the Hubble Deep Space Field. And I was reading a book and I found out about the scientist who did that, and that he was kind of ridiculed because he wanted to point the Hubble and spend 10 days of valuable time looking at nothing out there just over the Big Dipper. Well, he hit the jackpot when he looked at nothing. And that's a very, very novel, very creative idea that probably some of the more mathematicians go, why are you wasting time doing that? It was probably the most important picture the Hubble took as far as the public was concerned.
Yes. So that was my colleague, Dr. Robert Williams. And yeah, he was the director at the time of the Space Telescope Science Institute. And he'd been hearing from people doing Hubble observations that they were seeing something that was interesting, and it was showing up in some of the deeper images that were being taken, that there are a lot more galaxies than expected. And so what he did was he put together a panel to advise him on how he should follow this up. You know, what would be the ideal approach to do that? And the panel basically made a set of recommendations that were very, I think the phrase, you know, low risk or conservative. And he basically decided that this was one of those moments that really called for a much more, you know, ambitious approach. So he decided to use his director's discretionary time to do that observation and sit there and just stare at that space for that long. And a lot of people told him he was taking too much risk, but in the end, it really paid off. And it's, you know, it's an iconic image.
Oh,
and
totally.
The science is just totally seminal. He changed.
No,
you know, that observation changed how we look at the early universe.
Well, in a lot of fields, people just do little incremental things. I'm thinking about this water pump that I can't tell you how it works, but the design is, it's like so beautiful. He probably just thought it up while he was, you know, when the mind's kind of idling, and it's going to be easy to build. It's not going to cause any maintenance issues. It's like one of those things where it's sort of like pointing at the telescope at nothing. You know, just a totally, totally new idea.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, one of the interesting outcomes to that Hubble Deep Field, in addition to the science, was it kind of pointed us in the direction that we had to go next, which is to build the James Webb Space Telescope, because
That's
we needed to move the observations into the infrared to see the most distant objects.
You could see more things. But when I first looked at that picture, I'm going, thousands of galaxies out there, all kinds of other worlds out there. And people ask me sometimes, you know, sort of fundamental questions. So when I think about some of the fundamental questions, I look at the Hubble Deep Space Field. And that's why that poster is on my refrigerator. This is the same background I've had since COVID, when we all of a sudden had to get all our stuff online. And I noticed you're blurring your living room there, I think. I don't have the bandwidth to do that. And I kind of like my background now. I just have to have enough plants there so you can't see the mess. I'm very careful to make sure my things that are messy don't show.
The James Webb Telescope, in one of its first results of images, has yielded surprising results about galaxies.
You know, we have mathematical models that predicted how many galaxies we would see at different ages in the early universe. And we're seeing in the earliest part of the universe a lot more galaxies, and they seem brighter than we expected. So we're kind of really excited, first of all, by this result, because anytime, you know, we get a result that potentially may, you know, upend our thinking about, you know, how cosmology works, that's very exciting. I think it's too early to say that yet. We're taking a lot of images, but to really do the science, we have to do what's called spectroscopy, where we pass the light from these galaxies through a prism or a grating that disperses the light, and then we can look at the chemical components of those galaxies, but we can also, you know, get a more accurate understanding of how distant they are. So we're kind of looking back right now to periods around, you know, 600 to 500 million years after the Big Bang, which is a whole new field of investigation compared to what we've been able to do with Hubble in the past. And this is enabled by the fact that we can take these pictures in the infrared. And the James Webb is designed to do infrared imaging. And, you know, you can think of infrared as heat radiation. So it's really measuring the heat radiation from these very first objects that, you know, were forming 600 to 500 million years after the Big Bang. So we're very excited by this right now, but there's just so many different new results coming from the James Webb every week that it's hard to, first of all, it's hard to keep up. And James Webb is also an observatory, so we're seeing a lot of results across a lot of new science fields. We're also studying planets around other stars, and we're also studying objects in our own solar system, and that's also been very exciting already. You know, we're finding new asteroids. We're also seeing, you know, plume materials from one of Saturn's moons, Enceladus, which is really exciting because we think, you know, that there may be the possibility to search for evidence of life there in the future. So there's a lot of really exciting things happening right now with the first Webb results that are coming out.
Well, when I look at all that stuff, I'm going, there's got to be intelligent life out there on those galaxies. As Star Absolutely. Trek would call it, class M planets.
So we're starting to look at the atmospheres of smaller sized planets with James Webb, but they're all very exotic planets. So one of NASA's long-term goals, and this is based on a recommendation from the National Academies, is to build a telescope in the future that will be able to search for habitable planets and then see if there's evidence of life. And we're going to call this the Habitable Worlds Observatory. And we really are at that very early stage right now where we're sort of visualizing what this telescope would look like based on what the scientific demands are, and also what we've done already in terms of technical breakthroughs building the James Webb Space Telescope.
Well, it makes me think about all the history of science, that each time you get a new technology that enables you to see things better or measure things better, there's big discoveries. I'm just thinking about the microscope, for example, and they discovered little creepy crawly things in pond water that they didn't know were there, because they now had a new technology for seeing.
So Webb and the future habitable worlds, I find really sort of interesting, because you kind of have scientific challenges that tackle very small numbers, but also very big numbers. So when you think about, or when I think about the big numbers, you know, we have instruments that we call coronagraphs, and they block out the light from a star, so you can look at the very faint region around that star looking for planets. And on Webb, we can suppress that light from the star in the middle down to factors of around 10 to 100,000. To be able to image Earth-like planets, we need to go to factors of 10 billion. So that's, you know, a very big number. But in order to do that, we need to make the telescope something like 100 times more stable than Webb. So push down from, you know, the nanometer regime into the picometer regime. So it's kind of achieving a big number by making another number much smaller. I find it very interesting to think of it in those terms.
Well, I'm thinking about how the general public looks at it, and I have to say I really loved it when I found out that the deep space field of the Hubble was achieved by pointing it at a piece of space that didn't have anything obvious, and it pointed at nothing and find everything. That really turned me on.
Yeah, it's just so amazing. And one of the things we've done very early on with James Webb Space Telescope is to use nature's magnifying glass to give us an even bigger sort of bump than we would have got just using the telescope. And that's by using these big clusters of galaxies that are very massive, and the mass of those clusters of galaxies bends light, as Einstein said it would. Yeah. And so we're able to magnify images of galaxies that are much further behind these big superclusters of galaxies. And that gives us, you know, this additional edge in, you know, searching for the very first galaxies and stars that formed in the universe.
One of the things that you're thinking about, the and you were talking about the Hubble Deep Space Guild, that some of the more mathematical people said it was too risky. And okay, the only thing he'd risk is waste 10 days of his discretionary viewing time.
Absolutely.
That it maybe you come up with nothing, but sometimes that happens in exploration. But thinking about it visually, although he's probably saying, so the worst thing can happen is I just find nothing. I would have used up my discretionary viewing time and people are going to be making fun of me and stuff like that. But it was worth trying.
Yeah. I think at the time when Dr. Williams was thinking about this, you know, Hubble time was extremely valuable. You know, it was very hard to get observing time. So yes, every year on Hubble and on James Webb, there's a competition to get time to use the telescope.
Okay.
The oversubscription rates are always the order of 7 to 10 to 1. And, you know, in the 1995 period, it was extremely competitive. So the idea of using even that much time to do something, what was, you know, called a serendipitous study, was kind of considered, you know, risky, just because you might use up all that time and not find
anything.
Well,
maybe would you think of, you know, maybe he would have not been able to have done, not been director, because he could just
say, agree.
I'm director, I'm going to use up my time for this.
I think you have put your finger on it there. If somebody had written a proposal, ask for that much time,
it's down, like,
yes,
terrible.
I don't think it's unlikely they would have
done with a proposal. It would have never happened.
Right.
But he was director, and he goes, I'm just going to go for it. And
exactly.
he had the power to say, I'm going to use this 10 days for this. And it was the best thing he ever did. Single most important picture it took.
No, it's a very important result. And it's kind of had an unbelievable impact across astrophysics in the last, you know.
Well, I remember I was in,
close to two
when I was in high school, I worshiped the astronauts. And when I was in college, people were walking on the moon. I remember going out in the backyard of a rented house where I was staying for a research internship and looking up at the moon and going, people are walking around up there. And that, there's that iconic picture of the big blue marble in space. And I've read a lot of the diaries and those books that astronauts have written, that that picture was not on the manifest or anything like that. An astronaut just took that Hasselblad and took it. It wasn't planned. In fact, the only thing is, a lot of engineers don't look at things that visually. That was very, very important. It made people really think about, you know, Earth's a finite environment.
I completely agree. I mean, when you see something like that, even if it's not on the schedule, you just have to capture it, right?
Well, yes.
And you're right. Things are very visual. I remember going to see the James Webb when it was in the clean room at Northrop Grumman. And, you know, we would look at charts. You know, NASA sort of does a lot of reviews and previews, you know, using PowerPoint charts. And you would look at the charts and you'd think, yes, that's going to be hard to assemble. But then when you actually went in the clean room, you know, in the, what they call the bunny suit, to, you know, make sure you don't put any dust on anything, you get a whole new understanding of just the level of complexity and what needs to be done, even to do very simple things like installing one, what we call a pin that would release after launch. You know, some of them looked very easy to do on paper, but when you got in the clean room and you looked at where the guy's got to put his hand to get in to get access, you know, once the telescope's reaching its final stages of integration, it really gave us a different perspective on, you know, the, not just the risk of doing that particular assembly, but also, are we doing this in the right order? Maybe we need to step back and look again at the order of integration or assembly for the parts and see if there isn't an easier way that we can do this that makes it more viable.
Well,
to
I wrote
put
in my
this
book,
particular piece together.
Engineers calculate risk, visual thinkers see risk.
One of the things that I've certainly seen during my career is we try to make sure that when we have discussions, we give everybody a chance to speak and, you know, hear their contribution or hear their thoughts on things. Because as you said, you know, people look at things in different ways.
Well, that's right.
And,
that's
you know,
absolutely
when you're
right.
doing design reviews, you want to hear from everybody in the room to make sure that you haven't missed something. So we try to have that culture.
The other thing is we got to keep
build.
The public turned on so that you get funding.
I think there's more to it than just the funding, though. I mean, I think, you know, the general public, the American taxpayer, you know, paying for these. So we want to show them that the investments are actually producing the science that we said they would produce. For me, another important aspect is that astronomy and astrophysics is a great STEM science. It's one of those that
it is.
You know, any kid
no,
can engage with.
It's kind of science. I'm going to bet you that some of these STEM type physicists that you have are probably on the autism spectrum. You see, autism goes from Einstein who didn't talk till age three to some space scientists that are doing all kinds of mathematical things to somebody in the fire department that comes up with a totally new design for a pump that's probably going to end up in every fire engine in that fire engine company makes.
So I think that NASA science also is a great way of bringing kids into STEM.
Oh, absolutely. 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 And what I talk about in a lot of my things is you've got to expose kids to interesting things to get them interested in interesting things. Because I think so many things start out with exposure, then they get interested, and then mentoring.
Dr. Clampin explains the major impact just one mentor had on his career.
One was a guy called Dr. Francesco Perese, who was my first postdoc advisor. He was also, actually, interestingly, the grandson of Guglielmo Marconi. And he was very engaged in building hardware. So I learned a lot from him about how to build instruments. But, you know, one of the key things he really taught me was once you've built an instrument to do an astrophysical or astronomical problem, you know, think about what else you can do to really push the envelope of some big problem with that instrument. Don't just build it to do problem
right.
A and stop. You know, he was always thinking, you know, what else can I do with this instrument? It'd be really neat that nobody else has done before.
And these innovations lead to other ones. Dr. Clampin explains that not only is it one of NASA's jobs to communicate to the public what they do and why, but there is another benefit as well.
Technology. You know,
every
mission we build is to some extent a one-off, which requires new and innovative technology. And all of that technology is developed in partnership with companies who then use it to commercialize aspects of what they've done.
That's right.
And a great example, I mean, it's very hard on the web. You know, people say to me, so what's the great technical breakthrough? And the simple answer is metrology. And, you know, of course, that doesn't really sort of resonate with people. But when you say to them, well, you know, we had to measure the shape of the mirrors, but we didn't want to build a big isolated area that wasn't picking up vibrations to do it. So we developed a camera that could measure the mirrors to the required sensitivity anywhere.
Yeah.
And that technology now is being used to do LASIK measurements when you go to the optician.
Okay, well, and that's the kind of, you know, dual use things really, really needs to get out there, because LASIKs is something that people understand. And,
exactly.
And so that's a technology that came from NASA.
You know, I'll give you another good example. We weren't the only people developing images, but a lot of the very early investments in cameras for cell phones was done on the original Hubble Space Telescope program back in the late 70s into devices called CCDs, or charge coupled devices. And they were used on the earlier generations of cell phones until the technology moved on. And now we use a different kind of device called a CMOS. But, you know, Hubble really push that technology along.
With technology and discovery rolling in from James Webb and predecessors, NASA has sights set on two future large space missions.
The first one is going to be called the Roman Space Telescope, and that is named after Nancy Grace Roman, who was one of the first associate administrators for science within the Science Mission Directorate where I work. And the Roman Space Telescope is what we call a survey telescope. So you can think of Hubble and James Webb as what I would call point and shoot, you know, where you take a picture and maybe that picture takes 2 or 3 days to take because you just stare.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, the survey instrument instead has a very large camera and it's going to survey the sky, and we're going to do a number of different experiments, mapping the outer regions of solar systems around other stars. We're going to try to understand the nature of dark energy, which is this mysterious force that is making the universe accelerate in its expansion as it expands. And we're looking for things that go flash in the night. This is a new field of science called time domain astronomy. And we now know that there are a lot of very events that only appear for a very short period of time and then not lost, but lost to us because we aren't looking in the right place at the right time.
Okay, now,
so we're going to be doing all these new science programs with this survey telescope.
Okay, now let's just explain, to somebody out at the airport or at a restaurant or something, in a way that why this is important. What do those things that flash that go away do? What do you think they do?
So there are a lot of different things that produce what we call transient events, but let me give you an example of one that's been very exciting for astrophysics. And this is the collision of two neutron stars, or the merging of two neutron stars. When neutron stars merge, they produce this burst of high energy. So we detect that as what are called gravitational waves. We see, you know, a burst of gamma rays, really extreme burst of gamma rays, a burst of soft X-rays.
I have to ask you a basic question. When two neutron stars collide, do they just instantly blow up?
Pretty much. You get an event that we call a kilonova. So it's that you do get this very big explosion, and as a part of that, you get this, you know, enormous burst. And then you also get a flash of light.
It's hard for me to understand things that big could instantly go away.
So some of them, you just see a flash of gamma rays and that's it, it's gone. You don't see that flash again. Sometimes you're able to see the what we call the counterparts or the remnants of that event later on. So we saw back in 2017 the merger of two neutron stars, and it was actually detected initially as a gamma ray and a gravitational wave event. And that one, we were very lucky. We were able to actually figure out where it occurred and then go and study the counterpart using the Hubble Space Telescope. And one of the things that told us as we collected data was that this event had also produced a lot of very heavy elements, you know, like gold and other heavy elements in the universe. So this actually changed some of our thinking about how those heavy elements are actually produced in the universe.
Well, that, you know, that, okay, I can relate to that. Now I'm thinking about things like, well, nickel's not that heavy an element, but things on the periodic table we need to have in our electronic devices.
Yes.
And so knowing where this stuff comes from is sort of like mind-blowing.
Yes, and we're just starting to find all these, you know, events that, you know, produce these instantaneous bursts of energy, and then we're quickly able to, you know, follow up with other telescopes, we aren't able to observe them again. And, you know, one of the other things that the Roman's going to be doing is just using a technique called microlensing, which is using the mass of a star to detect planets around a star that passes behind it. So that would allow us to understand what kind of distribution of planets there are in other solar systems.
Really interested outer edges. You see, the things that interest me, I can really get interested in what Star Trek calls class M planets. Planets that could have maybe intelligent life on them. I remember reading in New Scientist years ago, and I never believed it, but like 30 years ago, I read something that they didn't think there'd be any other habitable planets in the universe. And after seeing the Hubble Deep Space Field, I go, rubbish. There should be other planets out there. There were physicists saying that. It's a long time ago, but right after the Hubble Space Telescope picture came out, that they didn't think they'd find any habitable planets. And I go, I think that's rubbish, because we are in a galaxy, and there's galaxies that look just like our galaxy and probably have habitable planets on them. That's the kind of stuff, having a device that enables you to sense the presence of a habitable planet. That's something I understand.
So that's the next big telescope we'll be building. We're looking at the possibility of building a telescope that's probably another 6 meter diameter telescope. And its scientific goal is to search nearby stars and try to image the Earth-like planets or habitable planets around those stars when they exist. And then follow that up by looking for what we call biosignatures, which are features in the spectrum of the atmospheres of those planets that indicate
there's, you know, what elements are there. And then, of course, one thing is, I mean, I was a big Star Trek fan, you know, they talk, we're carbon-based life. Now I'm seeing pictures in my mind of these sea worms down in a sulfur hot vent in the bottom of the ocean. You know, there might be some other kind of life, but you've got to have a somewhat temperate climate.
Yes.
Probably to have a lot of life, because a lot of stuff burns up when it gets really hot. So you're looking for like a rather temperate temperature. And then you have all different magical ways when you're doing your physics to tell me that, well, I'm going to call it a class M planet, one that is not totally below zero ice or just burning up. Elements there that could support life.
That's exactly correct. So, you know, we'll be looking for that region around stars where planets could have liquid water. But the point is that we'll be actually imaging these planets for the first time. It's very hard to do that.
No, I know it's hard, but you see, that's something when we talk about planets and things like that, I think the public really understands that in a way better than some of the other things, where the why of doing it is less understandable to me than finding class M planets. You know, there's the old thing, we're not probably not alone in the universe. And there's a lot of great people ask me about all kinds of things, spirituality, all kinds of stuff. And I say, well, I just look at the Hubble Space Deep Space Field, or I'll go online and pull up some of your pictures when I'm thinking about some of these big questions.
Absolutely.
And I just hope that this program is going to help inspire kids, because I'm like in my 70s now. And I think that what I need to be doing is, you know, inspire the younger generation to get out and get into interesting careers. It's really important to me. And I have young kids write to me and tell me that I inspire them. They also ask me, well, how do you overcome obstacles? I said, you overcome an obstacle one thing at a time. And I gave two talks to veterinary students. And they said, well, how do I overcome obstacles? Well, I know you've got taking a really hard class right now. Right now, you have to pass that class. Let's just worry about that, passing that class one obstacle at a time. That's what I told them.
Exactly. Yeah, we're at the problem at hand.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm going to have to take off. And thank you so much.
Okay.
I really enjoyed talking to you. I wish I didn't have to take off quite so quickly.
Understood. Thank you.
That was NASA astrophysicist Dr. Mark Clampin speaking with Temple Grandin. How'd You Think of That is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center. I'm Sherry Quinn. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grant number 174-5674.